You're listening to KHENLPFM Radio, 106.9, Salida, Colorado. And we're streamed on the internet at khen.org. And unfortunately, I can't figure out how to do this player, so I'm not going to play a song. I'm just going to go right on into the interview tonight. And the views expressed on this program are those of myself and or my guests and do not necessarily reflect the views of the KHEN staff, volunteers, or board of directors. And I would say if you would like to listen to tonight's program or any past programs of Truth Quest, if my website comes back up, they'll be available at www.givemesometruth.info or linked from the khen.org website. And I'm Melody, and my co-host tonight is Katie O'Brien. And I've got a couple of men in training here, which we always like to do with the community-supported radio, is to bring in new DJs and hosts for our radio programs. And so they're going to learn some of the ropes on how to do this thing live. And again, I also want to mention, you know, we've got a number of new programs that have live DJs, and I want to, you know, promote some of them, like Sunsplash and We the People and Block Party. Block Party with Rich and Country Fried Chicken with Rebecca, and then we've got Burning Chicken with Irving, and that's who one of them here in the room right now, and I've got William also, who's in training, and we've also got Shannon with Eclectica on Wednesday night. So I want to bring up my guests. Are you there, Katie and
yes.
Teresa? We got the volume levels right here. Can you hear me all right?
Yes.
Okay, great.
Are you able to hear Teresa?
You might want to speak up just a little bit more, Teresa.
Okay, I'm here.
Okay, and I'm going to say that tell you a little bit about Teresa and her. And Teresa Stanfield Benz was born into the Catholic faith in a small Kansas town in 1951. She attended Catholic schools through eighth grade, attended public high school in Denver, and married her high school sweetheart in a Catholic ceremony following graduation. She's the mother of four children, grandmother of nine, and she and her husband recently celebrated their 40th wedding anniversary. Benz began her writing career in high school as an assistant feature editor of the school paper. Her first published work appeared in a traditional Catholic publication in 1979. Since that time, Benz has written numerous articles exposing the conspiracy and the subversion of the Catholic Church. She also is the author of several self-published works on the subject, in addition to working as an award-winning community newspaper reporter in Texas and Colorado for the past 15 years. Over a 25-year period, she has assembled a library of approximately 4,000 Catholic books and pamphlets, most written before the death of Pope Pius XII. For a detailed explanation of what happened to the Church, why it happened and how it was divided, even its own members, visit our website at www.betrayedcatholics.com and click on any of the sidebar option topics. Teresa, is there anything more you want to add to this?
No, I think that pretty well sums it up.
Okay, because I'm still getting your levels. There we go. I can hear you. There, let's do that better. Sometimes it helps to have my headphones turned up. So, where would you like to begin?
You know, I think probably the only place I can begin is from the beginning.
Okay.
And that is, you know, that most people who know anything about the Catholic faith know that Catholics believe that Christ directly established the Catholic faith on earth, and that he appointed St. Peter as head of the Roman Catholic Church, and that he, in turn, ordained and consecrated the apostles. Christ ordained and consecrated the apostles, and St. Peter's successors succeeded him in the papacy, and that they are the direct representatives of Christ on earth. I mean, that it's a real, that is what the Catholic Church basically believes, that her succession is everything, that Christ and the apostles established the church, and the church has continued in an unbroken line since that time to the present, and that, well, not exactly to the present, but since that time to the recent past, let's put it that way, and that's what the church has always been based on, and she has always taken all her teachings from Christ and from basically from the Bible and from the traditions of the church and the teachings of the apostles and the fathers and the doctors and the popes, and that's basically where Catholics are coming from. That's what they're all about. You know, the church has had, you know, in the early ages, the church was very, she was persecuted relentlessly by the pagans and the Romans, and, you know, gave up many martyrs, which only made her more fruitful in the end. And it wasn't until, you know, probably the 4th or 5th centuries that she actually began establishing herself in Rome as the church that she later became. And, you know, it was a long, involved process, and there were many bumps in the road along the way. But she never lost her papal succession, her apostolic succession, her succession of vicars from Christ. She never lost that. There were dips and periods of time when there was no pope, and sometimes there was a period of time when people weren't sure who was pope, but the church later clarified those things, and actually she has, in clarifying who was pope, the Catholics believe that the church has the right to, you know, decide who was or was not pope based on very, of course, serious evidence, and that when they do decide such a person was pope, that, you know, during a disputed period of time, that you have to believe that.
What do you say?
It only happened, it happened quite a bit in the first 1,000 years. There were several instances where, you know, there was a lot of fighting between different nations going on, and the papacy was under siege for a while as far as different emperors wanting to rule her and wanting to appoint popes, and there was a lot of confusion, and a lot of people were being murdered right and left, and not necessarily in the church, but around, you know, the around the Vatican. I mean, it was some of the anti-popes, or who people thought at that time were anti-popes, were being murdered, and others were. It was a very bad time, and these were the times that a lot of people, when they talk about the papacy, and they, you know, say that there are bad popes. These are the times people refer to. Some of the bad popes they're talking about actually were later declared anti-popes, and a few, and only a few, of them were popes who were quite a bit less than what the church would have liked them to be, but still were not licentious or and never taught anything against the faith during their reign.
Explain what licentious is.
Being, you know, morally depraved, being... you know, loose with your tongue, loose with your speech, you know, your money. I mean, just doing things basically in an exaggerated manner that isn't usually in line with holiness and right behavior.
And how do you answer to some of them that say the Catholic Church was a conglomeration of various things, anywhere from pagan practices to Roman practices? What do you say to that?
You know, I think if a person sat down and looked over, you know, many centuries of paganism and the advent of different religions, you could say that probably about a lot of different religions. But the people, if the people who, let me explain a little bit about the people who are saying, who have been saying some of these things. And I have a specific, and I think we discussed at one point, there's a work out that basically it was written in the 1800s, and that work basically discusses this very thing that we're talking about. Well, I think the history of this work is important for people to understand where it came from. Number one, the research is greatly lacking. In order to produce a book that claims to prove what this individual said he was proving, you'd have to write several volumes. I mean, it's nothing in the Catholic Church for, you know, several volumes to be written on one topic. This person tries to cover several different areas and point out several different similarities in Catholic worship and the Catholic faith, you know, between that and pagan religions. And he doesn't even offer any real evidence. I mean, you would have to take volumes and volumes of work in order to be able to prove what he says he is proving. And in actuality, if you sit down, well, first, before I even go into that, first it's important to know when he wrote and who he was more than likely associated with, and that is somebody called the Know-Nothings. At the time that work was written, it was in the 1850s, the Know-Nothing Party was very active in the United States, and they were basically a secret society. And they when asked, you know, what the doings were at their meetings, they'd tell people, "I know nothing," because they took an oath of secrecy. And it was founded by Charles Allen. And it was in Massachusetts. It was first called the Order of the Star-Spangled Banner. And it was protesting at the time the fact that, I mean, their membership was protesting secretly. People didn't know this, but, I mean, some of it leaked out, of course, that they didn't like the fact that there were so many Catholic immigrants coming to America displacing Protestant immigrants. And they, especially the Irish and the Germans, and they were arriving in record numbers between 1820 and 1845, and they were taking jobs away from people, and they were crowding the cities and creating what a lot of people would refer to as, you know, chaos. And they basically wanted to stem that immigration, if at all possible, and point out to people that, you know, the Irish were drunks, the Irish were Catholics, Catholics were drunks. I mean, their reasoning was somewhat circular there. But, you know, they went into, they promoted prohibition, and they wanted to restrict public school teaching to the Protestants only, but they were very, very rapidly anti-Catholic. So much so that, I mean, the hatred they preached against the Catholics is just phenomenal. And what is even more phenomenal is the fact that, you know, it's so easily, if you look at what they're saying, it can be so easily disproven. Because, you know, hatred never breeds the truth. If you're a prejudiced and you start out with a prejudiced mindset, you're not going to be, and that's not an objective investigation. And the work that, you know, the best way to explain that this work was not what it is saying, you know, that it is that what this man is saying that Catholics basically teach, they don't teach at all. In the first place, if you go to for review, and do you want me to mention the name of this work?
Yeah, go ahead.
It's The Two Babylons, and if you go to a review of it, it's advertised as a scholarly classic. And it's saying that there are a lot of, you know, they mention O Nimrod and that, you know, Christ didn't, you know, organize, you know, the Catholic Church, and there's just a lot of different things that they're talking about there.
And who's they?
And go ahead.
Who is they?
The author of the work is I had it here a minute ago. Hislop. His last name is a Reverend Hislop, and I think he was associated. Like I say, I don't know what his exact association was. I don't know whether he was a Protestant, but I don't know what denomination he was. But he was very obviously not, you know, he was very obviously anti, you know, Catholic. He just didn't care for them. His name is Alexander Hislop, and his work was first published as a pamphlet in 1853, and then it expanded in 1858, and that's exactly at the time the Know-Nothings were in existence. And what is really funny is I have a work here, and it's called How Christ Said the First Mass. And if he had just looked at the Jewish religion, he would have understood that the Catholic Church, he talks about, oh gosh, he talks about candles, for example. He talks about, you know, the different rituals we have and everything. If anybody would research the Jewish religion, they would find that almost everything that the church took for her own was taken from the Jewish faith. In fact, so much so that it is almost, many of the worship, the articles of worship, many of the not the ceremonies, but the symbolism, much of the symbolism and the trappings of the altar and that sort of thing were carried over simply because the Catholic Church views the Old Testament and the New Testament as a continuum. The Jews were intended to come into the church, you know, according to Catholic belief and teaching, and she considers it a continuum. She doesn't see that there is a breaking point there. She believes that the Old Testament flows into the New Testament, and it flows as one river of faith, and, you know, or it should. I mean, and that she, it's amazing when you sit down and read this, how Christ said the first Mass. What all, how much of Jewish belief, even in some respects, and in tradition and ritual, is incorporated into the Catholic belief system. And if this gentleman had just had that knowledge at hand, I doubt very seriously if he would have ever said some of the foolish things he said in that book. And I say foolish because if they're saying that this is pagan, they're going to have to say that Judaism is pagan also. And we know for a fact Judaism was never a pagan religion. It was the only religion that professed belief in the one God.
Okay, so go ahead.
No, I just, you know, there's a few things you can point out. You know, he mentions the significance of candles, and Mr. Hislop, this Reverend Hislop, says that the priests of Rome locked the Bible away from the people, and there are many people that make that silly statement, and I say silly because it probably sounds great to them, but when you're Catholic, you know that all of your ceremonies, all of your, everything that you learn as a child, everything that you participate in as an adult, everything that you use, everything you read in your missal, in your devotionals, it's all taken directly from the Bible. And that's why I can't understand how so many people could eat. I mean, all you have to do is pick up a Catholic missal and look, and they'll have the Gospels and epistles. I mean, it's an essential part of the Catholic belief and worship system.
Okay, and what is a missal?
A missal is what you officiate at Holy Mass with. When you go into, well, not today's churches, but in the 1950s, when they were still saying the Latin Tridentine Mass in churches throughout the world, you would take a missal into a church. And in the front part of your missal, you're going to have the different feast days or the different Sundays and holy days, some of the holy days, and all the lessons. And you have the epistle and the gospel, and they're all taken from Holy Scripture. Some things are taken from the Old Testament, but nearly all of it's taken from the New Testament. And you'll have all of your the Mass itself. There's, you know, a lot of things incorporated from the earliest traditions of the church. I mean, the Mass is nothing but the words of Christ enshrined in different prayers. The words of Christ over the bread and wine, and creating the bread and wine as his own body. Though anything else around that, it's a shrine to Holy Scripture. People, if they would look at a missal, would understand that not only are we not forbidden to, you know, read it, we have to read it as part of our own belief system and in honoring Christ and what he taught. It would be impossible for a Catholic not to read the Bible and still be a Catholic.
What version of the Bible are we talking about?
The Douay-Rheims.
The what?
The Douay-Rheims.
Explain that.
The Douay-Rheims was the first Bible ever printed. I mean, it, well, not Gutenberg Bible, It was a commentary on the original Douay, I believe, and I'm not. Bear with me because I'm not exactly sure about this, but it was one of the earliest Bibles printed. I mean, it was the Catholic Church was the only one that had, you know, access to the Bible before the Reformation. I mean, Gutenberg printed, well, I believe he printed a Catholic Bible, and there's different. The Douay, there's Douay Challoner Bible. There's Douay Reims. Reims is a place in France, and Douay is a university, and they were responsible for the translation. I believe that's where it came from. But there was also, at one time, there was a commentary, a rather lengthy commentary. We've only got footnotes of that commentary left now because people, over the years, you know, wanted to concentrate not on commentary but on the scripture, which is as it should be. Although if you want to go into depth and study the Bible, you're encouraged to also examine, of course, the commentary. But it was the only Bible for quite a while, and then the King James Version came out, and that was the only Bible for quite a while. I mean, it the only other Bible. And then, of course, various other versions were printed later. So.
Okay, now, when you're talking about, when was this version first translated or interpreted or whatever?
You know, it evolved. The monks in the monasteries for many years, you know, would sit and copy these things. I mean, they would copy it so that people could read it, and you know, I mean, that was the whole idea, and to preserve it, of course. And the Bible is, you know, the Catholic Church. I think it was the Council of Carthage, I believe. The Catholic Church first declared what the books of the Bible were. Until that, no one really knew what the books, the authentic books of the Bible were. Some people contest the fact that she had the right to do that. Well, in Catholic belief, the Church is the vicar of Christ, therefore she has the right to do anything, you know, that, you know, Christ would have her do, and certainly his own words he entrusted. You know, he said he would bind in heaven whatever they bound on earth and loose in heaven whatever they loosed on earth. So they certainly believed that they, you know, were able to interpret what the Bible meant and to declare what, you know, actually the Bible was. And the Bibles, which were collected, you know, in the early times, were, you know, They were all that they had at that time until, like I say, some of the other ones were printed. They were the first Bibles. The very first Christian Bible was produced by the Catholic Church and Catholic scholars in the second and third centuries, and they were approved for various, you know, Christians to read at the Council of Hippo.
I have to comment because my Jewish partner in here is he's agreeing with your facts here. So obviously you guys, you know, studying in the same direction here.
Okay.
it was just by accident this all happened too. Just that we had, and I'm glad to see that because I mean I like having to hear these different sides because I'll have to admit I'm not an expert in either avenue at all. So.
Well, and this is, you know, this is all a matter of written record. I mean, it can be, you know, researched like anything else. But, you know, the very first Bibles came out in the second and third century just for the use of the Christian people. And of course, they were precious back then because the printing press hadn't. And so it wasn't that the Catholics couldn't read them. It was that they were, it's like reference books at a library. You can't take them home. That's what kind of confused people. And then it was, you know, as time wore on and everything, you know, we had, like I say, the different versions of the Bible, of course, but it, from the very earliest times, you know, it was very much part of Catholic belief and worship.
Okay, now when you said that they came out with the King James, did they adopt the King James, or did they just stay with their own interpretation?
When they came out with the King James Bible, it did not contain all the books of the Douay Reims Bible. One of the books, there were several books left out of the King James Bible, and I'm sorry to say I don't know exactly what they were. One of them was Maccabees, and I believe whatever, and that is where we take a lot of what our belief in purgatory is, and that's why the Protestants say we have a wrong belief in purgatory. Well, it's because they don't have that particular book of the Bible.
Okay, but isn't there a faction of the Catholic Church that when they split between the Orthodox and the Roman Church, that kept with the Maccabees in those other versions or other books?
The Catholic Church has always had the Book of Maccabees. The
okay.
Protestants were the ones
that dropped
don't have
it.
Those books.
Okay, all right, okay.
And we've always kept them. And so, I mean, and like I say, there's other books that were taken out that, you know, were, you know, just, I'm not sure why they were removed, but the Protestants, I guess, found them offensive in some way, or found that they felt that they weren't true books or something. I don't know exactly what the reason was. I'm sure that they felt like they kind of had to, you know, establish themselves as having some kind of authority and being you know, able to do some of the things that the church did, and they just found that objectionable, so they removed those books from the Bible.
Okay. Now, if we get, I mean, because what we kind of wanted to do was to get into a little bit of how the church or the betrayal with the church, and also some of the myths that people have picked up that are attached to that. Do you want
exactly
to, right? So, if we you want to, did okay. we get a basis of where you wanted to begin first of all, or
sure?
You,
okay. And yeah, before we get sidetracked, or before I get sidetracked here, that'd be good. Basically, you know, the church had, I mean, she remained one pretty much up until, you know, and not that there weren't problems, but the church was one up until the Reformation. When the Reformation came along, of course, there were several different Protestant factions that established themselves as different churches and said that Rome was wrong, that she was evil, that she was even the Antichrist, and Luther was probably one of the most prominent among the Protestants who claimed this. And Calvin wasn't much farther behind him, but it was about that time that all of the myths about Rome being, the papacy being the Antichrist, emerged. And it was actually a tenet of establishing the Protestant religion. I mean, they, in order to establish, they had to basically say that it was evil and wrong and was, you know, the antithesis of what people thought it was, in order to have any credibility in the eyes of the people, and they did. They, you know, they taught the papacy itself was the Antichrist, and a lot of people believed it, and there had been some abuses. I mean, there's no sense saying there wasn't. I mean, the church worked hard all the time to correct those abuses, and there's proof of this in her own documents. It's not something that is hard to prove. And, you know, there...
Were they easily available documents when you're talking about these proofs?
They were read, or and sometimes they were read from Rome. Some they were usually issued to the bishops and to the cardinals and the hierarchy of the church, who read them from the pulpit to the people. That's usually how these documents were spread back then. Of course, you know, and after printing came into vogue, of course, they were available in print as well. The Vatican always kept their own archives of all these things, but, you know, it's been, you know, there's ancient copies of these things that are, you know, proved that they were the same then as they are now, on display all over the world in different places, because they were public documents, and they were, like I say, sent to the different officials of the church to be read to the people, especially the encyclicals and the constitutions, because it was a norm of Catholic acting. The Catholics believe that they have to obey the Pope. Well, they can't obey him if they don't know what he's telling them to do. So they had to be read to the people.
Okay, when
and
you
now
said
they're available. I mean, almost anything you want back to probably around the 1700s and even beyond that is easily available on the Internet and from other places.
When you said constitutions, what are you talking about?
A constitution is just an official statement or declaration, an official document. It's not like a constitution as we understand our American Constitution. It's just another word for allocution, I mean, there's different grades of papal documents. There's encyclicals, there's allocutions, which is a simple address. There's bulls, which have great authority. There's constitutions, which are usually on disciplinary and more legal matters. And there's solemn and infallible declarations made publicly from the chair of Rome, which are no less, I mean, these other things are no less infallible than those, but they're just done with greater solemnity. They're made known in a greater manner because they're usually greater, or in a more solemn manner because they're usually greater truth. So that's the only difference. But lest I stray any further from where I'm trying to go, you know, the people always had access to these things. And over the years after the Protestant, you know, Reformation came, like I said, there was greater access than ever before. Now, in the 1500s, we find the first evidence of Freemasonry becoming a public body or a semi-public body. And it's no coincidence that this happened right after the Reformation. The anti-Catholic feeling was at high pitch, and Freemasonry throughout its history has been... its main enemy is Catholicism, and it is even said that in its own documents. The first signs of it, like I say, were probably in the 1500s, but they weren't really the body that they later became in the 1700s. By the time they reached the 1700s, they were they're fully developed and teaching just about everything that we know them to teach today. The strange thing is a lot of people have said that the church of today and the church of even the past, a lot of people have said that church is itself behind the conspiracy. And I recently wrote an article for another website that proves that far from being part of the conspiracy, the church is a victim of this conspiracy and has been for several centuries. And it's amazing to me that so many people don't know, and they really don't know that it was the Catholic Church that warned against Freemasonry beginning in the 1700s. Pope Clement was the first to sound the alarm.
And what was the warning against the
Masons? I'm getting to that right here. The warning, basically, the one that most Catholics of today are most familiar with is the one given in Humanum Genus by Pope Leo the 13th. And he was very clear about what we should... What Freemasonry was. He wrote, "Once the fear of God and the reverence due to his laws have been taken away, the authority of rulers treated with contempt, free reign and approval given to sedition, popular passions recklessly fanned, and all restraining influences eliminated except the fear of punishment, then there will necessarily follow a revolutionary upheaval and a period of wholesale destruction of existing institutions." Of existing institutions.
So that sounds like it's not only against the Catholic Church, but it could be against governments or any other form of organization.
No. I have to let me find the space here where he talks about the actual Masonic conspiracy itself. Here's something from, we'll go back a little further. Here's something from Pope Gregory. "You should recall that certain societies and assemblages seem to draw up a battle line together with the followers of every false religion and cult. They feign piety for religion, but they are driven by a passion for promoting novelties and sedition everywhere. They preach liberty of every sort. They stir up disturbances in sacred and civil affairs and pluck authority to pieces. This is the hour granted to the powers of darkness to grind the elect as wheat. Evil comes out of secret societies. Those conspiring societies have vomited as into a privy all they hold of licentiousness, sacrilege, and blasphemy."
And go ahead.
No, go ahead. go ahead with your question.
Well, to an extent, maybe one of the myths out there is in regard to almost like the priesthood being a secret society. My understanding is that back in the 50s, all masses were held in Latin, but many parishioners here in the United States didn't speak Latin.
You know, Is that a myth? Yes, it is a myth. Let me explain this. This has been so misunderstood. When I was in third grade, I was 8 years old, and I'd gone to Mass on a daily basis probably for 2-3 years. When we got to be about that age, we had made our first communion already, and we were handed missals. The very missal I'm sitting here thumbing through at the moment is the very one I received as a gift at that time and used. And if you open that missal to the ordinary of the Mass, on the left-hand side, you are going to find the Latin. On the right-hand side, you are going to find the English. And it is set up in such a way that you know every phrase of Latin in English. I had the Mass memorized in Latin by the time I was in sixth grade, pretty much. All the responses and a lot of the other material that was in the Mass. But you have one page, you have your left-hand side, Latin, your right-hand side, English. No Catholic ever had an excuse for thinking that we were ignorant of Latin. You can go to any Latin dictionary if you have a question about whether such and such is interpreted. We have the authority of the Church, who only authorized certain companies to make translations of these missals.
Well, thank you for eliminating that myth. Because I think a lot of people are under that impression.
Well, my point is, if an 8-year-old kid can figure it out by the time they're, 9 or 10, I mean, it's not if you're trained to it. Now, it would be hard for someone to just come in fresh and look at it. If you're trained to it, it's not hard. And it's beautiful. There's a reverence and a beauty about it that I wish people, sadly, that Mass no longer exists. They did away with it.
You know,
and it no longer exists. That Catholic Mass ceased to exist April 3rd, 1969.
And why was it eliminated?
Well, it's a long story. But what basically happened is, and there's a lot more I'd like to read from the Pope's on Freemasonry, because it's very important that people know how and why they condemned it. But
go ahead.
Okay, let me see if I can't find Leo the 13th's words, because he says basically in Humanum Genus that today evildoers all seem allied in a tremendous effort inspired by and with the help of a society powerfully organized and widely spread over the world. It is the Society of Freemasons. In fact, those people no longer even try to dissimulate their intentions, but they actually challenge each other's audacity in order to assail God's august majesty. It is now publicly and overtly that they undertake to ruin Holy Church so as to succeed, if it is possible, in the complete dispossession of Christian nations of all the gifts that they owe to our Savior Jesus Christ. As a result, in the space of a century and a half, the sect of the Freemasons has made incredible progress, making use at the same time of audacity and cunning. Masonry has invaded all the ranks of social hierarchy, and in the modern states it has begun to seize a power which is almost equivalent to sovereignty.
Is there a relationship between the Masonry and the Muslim religion?
Very good question, and my answer would have to be yes. And the reason that I say that is because all of Freemasonry has its basis in the Middle East, and it especially issues forth from Egypt and the mystery religions. And to say that, and that's why when Reverend Hislop tries to say that the mystery religions were responsible for Catholicism, it's responsible for Freemasonry, not Catholicism. Freemasonry is the one who has preserved in its Masonic lodges all of the mysteries of early Egypt, of India, of all the Muslim nations. And many of these people were very active members, and In fact, you know, and I think this is a pretty generally known point, the best authors on Freemasonry will tell you, Nesta Webster, there, Robeson, Walt Hanna, they'll tell you that these mystery religions started out as secret societies of assassins, and their members were Muslims. And the word hashish actually comes, that's where our word assassin comes from. And what they would do is they would, and a lot of people challenged me on this, but maybe they were using something besides just hashish. What the history books and what the books on Freemasonry said they would do is tank them up on hashish and send them out to kill people. And this is where some of the early, you know, Masonic sects, this is what inspired them. I'm not saying that they were descended from that, but they took a lot of their teachings, a lot of their organization, a lot of their operation, methods of operation from these people. I mean, it was, and if you trace back some of the lodges in those countries, you'll trace them back to those sects.
Okay, now where did the Jesuits come in on this and these different sects like the Franciscans and Dominicans and all this?
That is something that, and that, when you think Jesuits, you should think Illuminati, because basically, the accusations leveled against the Jesuits were instigated by the Illuminati. They needed a front for their organization, and they were concocting that organization long before it actually became public. And there were different branches of it. It wasn't maybe official for a while, but when it did become official, the first people they pointed to were the Jesuits, so that they could cloak what they were doing, and they blamed them for much of what they themselves did.
And what time period is this?
This is probably, I'm going to say it's the 1760s and 1700s.
Okay.
There's some very, Robeson is probably one of the best authorities and one of the most trusted authorities. He was a Mason himself. He left Masonry because he said it became something that he didn't recognize anymore, and that he couldn't, you know, stay in something that had become, you know, basically something that wasn't what it started out to be. And I don't think necessarily it was an evil society to begin with. I think it was just a society of people that were builders and perhaps, you know, in other professions. But it became, after the Protestant Reformation, it very quickly became a society of people that, I think the seeds were planted by Jacques de Molay and during the time of the Crusades. The church condemned Freemasonry when they condemned Jacques de Molay and burned him at the stake. I mean, well, the church didn't burn him at the stake. The state burned him at the stake, but they condemned Jacques de Molay. Philip LaBelle burned him at the stake, basically. And the church was cursed for that. The church was cursed to die and cursed for all eternity. And Philip LaBelle did die, and they've been trying to get the church ever since. But she's been, you know, that is why Freemasonry has been after the church, and has used every calumny, every deceit that you can, you know, possibly imagine, to bring her to ruin. Weishaupt was the one. He was a Catholic at one time. He even taught canon law, and he had long been scheming. Robeson said to establish an association or order which, in time, would govern the world. And in his first fervor and high expectations, he hinted to several ex-Jesuits the probability of their recovering under a new name the influence which they formerly possessed and of being again of great service to the society by directing the education of youth of distinction. Well, as Robeson relates in his book, he started out with several ex-Jesuits, and after they'd been with him for a while, they were like, no, we can't go here, we're leaving now. And what he wound up with was far from anybody you could recognize as a Jesuit. Now, he only started out with them by not becoming clear about exactly what he was doing. They say here he hinted to several ex-Jesuits that they could recover their former status. That was after the Jesuits had been disbanded by the Pope. The Pope disbanded them not because he thought they were evil and doing wrong, but because he couldn't establish the fact that they were not, he didn't know exactly what was going on. And until he could find out, and until he could investigate the matter further, he decided that they should be temporarily disbanded. Well, over the period of time, of course, they got to studying the matter and realized that, well, yes, maybe Weishaupt in the beginning had recruited some ex-Jesuits, and by the way, they were also ex-Catholics, but you couldn't say that they were active and practicing Jesuits. You know, it would be like if I decided, you know, here I am a Protestant, and I'm going to go to the Catholic Church, and I'm going to become a Catholic now, and somebody comes along and says, oh, well, you know, that Protestant, look at that, look what he's saying, look what he's doing. Well, that Protestant is no longer a Protestant, he's a Catholic. So, I mean, it's easy to switch, you know, it's like the shell game. You know, you could have said that at one point that this or that person was a Catholic. But what people don't understand is the Catholic Church herself says once you abandon the faith and you join a Protestant sect or you join any other, you know, religious sect that isn't Catholic, you're no longer a member in the Catholic Church. So what happens at that point is that no one can call you a Catholic. The Catholic Church herself doesn't consider you a Catholic. So, yes, these people may have been ex-Jesuits that started out, but even this book says that they eventually, a lot of them eventually left Weishaupt because they realized that he was, what he was teaching was not a good thing.
Okay, so when you're taking, you got these different factions
Melody? I can hardly hear.
Okay, what would you call the difference between the Dominicans and the Franciscans and these other groups within the church? What are they? Are they monkdoms or what are they?
They're orders. They're various orders in the church. In the Catholic Church, we had over a period. For example, there's the Benedictines, there's the Dominicans, there's the Franciscans. And there's numerous other orders, and what usually happened was some very zealous and devout person would come along and say, let's all go over here and start a monastery and do nothing but love and serve God all day, and this is going to be our rule. Well, you know, Saint Benedict did this. He did this with his men who wanted to follow him, and Saint Francis did it. They were you know, the order, they were the poor. They specialized in serving the poor. The Order of Preachers, St. Dominic's group, they went around converting people from the Cathar heresy during the time of the Crusades. They all had different rules that governed their organizations. They all had different methods. And they all had different ways of loving, serving, and worshiping. Well, not worshiping, but different devotions they used in their worship and whatnot. So they all distinguished themselves by becoming different orders. And different orders also did different things. Some were nursing orders, some were missionaries, some were what they call contemplatives, which they were cloistered. They did nothing but praise and pray to God and contemplate His greatness, you know, all day, and they did, you know, they had little gardens, and they, you know, that was their whole life, was to love God and pray for other people. And these orders were, they were the prayers that fueled the holiness and success of the church and the people that, you know, were members of the church. It was because of those prayers and because of those people's dedication and love that the church was allowed to exist as long as she did.
So what do you think, I'm just lost my train of thought here. Oh, okay, now when you're talking about the people of the church being victims, how does this all tie into what we've been talking about, or have we gotten there yet?
Well, it's okay. Let's go back to the Freemasonry, the issue of Freemasonry. In the 1800s, the Freemasons made a major attack on the church and made some major inroads. So much so that at one point Pope Leo XIII wrote a prayer and said, "In the holy place itself, they have raised the throne of their abominable impiety with the iniquitous design that when the pastor has been struck, the sheep will be scattered." Now, he was telling us, without saying it, that the Freemasons were in the church. They'd already infiltrated the clergy. They'd done that, and some of the earlier popes, some of the other popes, already mentioned that in the letters that they wrote to warn people. But they'd already entered the church. Then, in 1846, there were two little seers who saw Our Lady appear while they were tending sheep, and it was called... they were at a place called La Salette, and Our Lady appeared to them and told them, she gave them a secret. And there's a lot of controversy around this secret. Some say that it was never meant to be talked about or commented on by people, but before anybody really knew that it probably shouldn't be discussed, it was discussed a great deal, and it was made public. And if you look at the secret itself, everything that that secret says has come true. And it's very hard when you see a prophecy come true not to think that it's not a true prophecy.
And but what was the prophecy?
Our Lady told the children that the church would appear to be destroyed, and that no longer would priests, that no longer would she produce priests worthy to offer the holy sacrifice, and that Rome would lose the faith and become the seat of Antichrist.
Wow.
And did she have a time frame for that?
You know, not that we know of. There's parts of the secret that we don't, you know, we aren't familiar. You know, it may say somewhere in there. I don't think that there was ever any time frame given. Now, Fatima was another story. There seems to have been a time frame given there. But it was not given specifically. It was more or less, and that, there's a lot of controversy around Fatima, and I don't care to get too much into that, but I believe it was an authentic apparition of Our Lady, but I think the fact that the seer, Lucia, was a nun who appeared to accept the modern church, I don't accept that. But what I was going to say, and to get on with the story, is, you know, through the ages, different popes condemned different things. Pope St. Pius X said in 1903 that he believed that the Antichrist had already been born. I think it was in 1903. He believed the Antichrist had already been born. Pope Benedict XV in 1917-1918 warned people about the dangers of one world government, and he was very, very specific about these dangers and he basically said that it would result in the Reign of Terror. Pius XI warned people in an encyclical that was never published, because he died before he could publish it. He basically warned people that, you know, it was wrong to persecute the Jews, that any kind of racial hatred was wrong, and that it was against the Catholic faith to do any of that. Pope Pius XII, for all the terrible things that have ever been said about him, and he has been maligned, I've never seen a pope maligned like he has been, and it's none of it's true. I have all the man's writings. There's no greater man, you know, as far as loving people and caring for people and trying to do everything he could during the war to help people, including the Jews, but also his own people. I don't see how anyone could have expected anything else from him. He was, he was congratulated and commended by the head rabbi of Rome for his treatment of the Jewish people.
And who was this again?
Pius XII.
And this was what time frame?
It was in the 1940s after the war. Isaac Herzog personally congratulated. I believe he was the head rabbi of Rome at that time. He personally congratulated Pius XII for all that he had done to help the Jews.
Okay, and what I've gotten information where, like, the current pope now came out of a part of the Nazi regime. Have you heard much anything along that line?
Let me finish my story, which is
okay.
Very quick. very, very close to being done. During World War II, a lot of people said Pius XII was pro-Nazi. That is absolutely not true. He was not only not pro-Nazi during the war and before he became he wasn't pro-Nazi as a pope, and he wasn't pro-Nazi before the war when he wasn't pope, when he was just the papal, he was stationed in Bavaria, and he was an envoy to Rome. And he wasn't then, at that time, he wasn't pro-Nazi then either. And there's proofs of this. Why they haven't published those proofs, I don't know. I think people would rather think that Pius XII is anti-Jewish. He wasn't. He spoke from Rome in the 40s, saying that we have to love the Jewish people, that they are Christ's people, and that we are not allowed to hate them. And that look at what it, you know, he basically said, look at what has happened. Excuse me, since, you know, the war and everything. Look at what's happened. Look at what this has done. But in any event, what basically happened during the war was that the church, you know, Rome was under siege for a while, you know, at one point. But everybody was put out of their, you know, regular place of living, their regular mode of living. I mean, everything was chaos during the war. And a lot of the directives from Rome couldn't go where they needed to go. And a lot of them, a lot of what some of the people in the Vatican were doing, Pius XII had no idea they were doing it. And one of those people was the man who would later become Paul VI. It was Giovanni Montini. Well, Giovanni Montini was acting as an actual double agent, and he was transmitting sensitive information out of the Vatican as fast as he could. In fact, there was a big scandal where he was responsible for having all the priests that were sent into Russia to help serve the Russians and convert them in the communist during, you know, the term of the communist regime. The church had sent these people in, and he notified one of the Russian officials where they were, and they were all murdered. It's also been said, and I haven't seen absolute proof of this, but I trust the source it came from. There's two different sources, actually, that Montini was running a brothel out of Rome. He was into a lot of things. Pius XII did not find this out until he was very close to his end. And when he did, by the time he found it out, he was so surrounded by people in the Vatican, there's not a lot he could do.
So who was he a double agent for?
Paul VI, he was working with the OSS and the CIA, from what I understand. But he, when I say he's a double agent, he was appearing to work for the Vatican, but he was actually working for Britain and the American government. And the church has always been very careful to draw lines. People don't think so. They ought to read Pius XII's addresses and encyclicals. The church does not sit on any side of a question. That's why some people were allowed to say that Pius XII was a Nazi lover and a Jew lover, and that, you know, people flip-flop depending on their ideology between those two things, you know, saying, oh, he was a bad guy, he was this, he was a bad guy, he was that. Well, it's because the church always tries very hard not to ever side with any political entity. It's like Pius XII said in one of his addresses, we love everyone, you know, equally. We don't have sides. We want to help both sides come to an agreement where they don't hate each other.
Okay.
That was Pius XII's whole thing. They called him the Pope of Peace, and he was. If you read his documents and everything he wrote, he loved the people that he served, and not just the Catholics. He loved everyone, Protestant, Catholic, Jew, everyone. He loved them all, and he wanted the war to end, and he wanted a better world for them, and he was willing to do anything except, you know, contradict and ignore the teachings of the church in order to do that. He stretched everything as far as he could. He made every possible exception he could without defying doctrine, without denying the truths of faith. And you know, what did he get for it in the end? Well, I think he was at one point poisoned. In the early 1950s, Montini was serving as his Secretary of State. And you know, you can't prove these things after the fact. I mean, my gosh, I was 2 years old at the time. You know, I mean, you can't prove these things now, you know, and you're certainly not going to get any answers from Rome at this moment. But he was supposedly subscribed to some kind of regime for his teeth, to keep his teeth clean. And the doctor came in and said, oh, no, you have to use this other kind of toothpaste. Well, come to find out, the toothpaste had mercury in it.
You said that Pius didn't know about this stuff because he was, like, protected or kept away from it. Who was keeping him away from the information?
Well, a Protestant clergyman actually had to break the news to him about Paul VI. Now, the reason he didn't know about it is a lot of it happened during the 40s when they couldn't always rely on the information they were getting, you know, through different war channels, or they weren't able to confirm the information because of war situations. After the war, it was easier to do that.
Okay, let me say that you're listening to Truth Quest with Melody on KHEN LPFM Radio, 106.9 Salida, Colorado, community-supported radio. And tonight I have my co-host Katie O'Brien, and our guest this evening is Teresa Benn, and she is speaking about the history of the Catholic Church and how the Catholics may have been hijacked. Is that correct?
That's correct.
Okay. So, go ahead.
Okay. How did he not know it? You know, it's a question I asked myself for a long time. And I guess you would have to understand, you kind of have to go back and look at what he said and how he acted. Did he know? And there are priests, there are some people that have said that at the end, in some of his biographies even, that at the end he was surrounded by enemies to such a point that he had no freedom of action, that he was basically kept in a bubble, and that he was afraid to. He was so old and frail, there's not a lot he could do. Well, if you understand elder abuse, I mean, it's not hard to see that, you know, an older person who's not, you know, who is being held captive, basically, I mean, they're not always responsible for not combating things that, you know, they should be, some people think they should be combating. He became, from the mercury poisoning, he became very, very ill in 53. That was shortly after he found out about Montini. Strange coincidence. Montini at that time was his secretary. He became very ill, and shortly after recovering, and they say it was a miraculous recovery. They don't know how he recovered from that. But after recovering, he basically fired Montini as his secretary. And usually when that happens, the person in question is made a cardinal. He did not make him a cardinal. And after that, he pretty much did everything in the Vatican by himself, as much as he was allowed. He made the decisions, he did the research, he didn't trust anybody. After he got burned by Montini, he didn't trust anyone. And he had a little helper, her name was Sister Pascalina, and she was a nun that had been basically there to cook and you know, help with different things from, you know, she was, of course, lived in another part of the Vatican, but she was, you know, she because he was old and frail, she was there to help take care of him. And between those two, I mean, for a long time, basically, the church was run. And you know, in the last years, because he trusted no one, and when he died, usually a pope does something called they appoint a cardinal camerlengo, which means a cardinal camerlengo is someone who comes along, and after the pope is dead, they take charge of the conclave and the election of the next pope. One of the most telling things about Pius XII is that he selected no cardinal camerlengo. And he did say to one of his trusted confidants before he died, after me there will be a flood. He knew what was happening. He knew what was coming. And after he died, they elected Angelo Roncalli. Now, Angelo Roncalli is better known as John the 23rd. Well, when Angelo Roncalli got in, it didn't take him long to announce the fact that he was going to hold a council. And it didn't take him long to announce the fact that he was thinking that all the windows in the church should be open and we needed a complete makeover. And he in 1959, I remember because I went to church and always sat by my mom. And I remember my mom going into the church pews, and she looked at the end of the church pews, and there was this funny-looking green book laying at the end of the church pew. And it's like, what is that? And, you know, she picked it up and looked at it, and she always used her Maryknoll missile, so she just kept using her missile and ignored the little thing in the end of the, at the end of the pew. Well, she got to looking at it one day, and I don't know if she found what I later found, but I know that I found it among her possessions when she died. And I have to think that she had some idea of what was going on, because it wasn't long after that that she told all of us kids, the communists have gotten into the church, and they've taken over. But what was in that book is the key to what happened to the Catholic Church. What was in that book is that the Catholic consecration of the Mass, which is the most hallowed part of the Mass, Christ's very words in consecrating the bread and the wine and making them his own body and blood. And the priest, of course, makes it his own body and blood. I mean, it was Christ's own body and blood, but he, in commemoration of his sacrifice, makes it Christ's body and blood. That very phrase where it says, in the consecration of the wine, where it says that this will be done for you and for many, was changed to for you and for all men. Now, that doesn't seem to most people like a big thing, but that was done in the books given to the laity in 1959. And any good Catholic who knows anything about their faith, and any good Protestant that knows anything about their faith, will go to their Bibles, the King James Version, as well as all Bibles, probably post-1940, because they started... Once they started the new translations, there was a lot of variation. But all the older Bibles that could go back as far as you want to go, no matter where you want to look, and I've got a lot of them on my shelves here, you look at any of those Bibles, it does not say for you and for all men. It says for you and for many in both Protestant and Catholic Bibles. And John the 23rd falsified the words of Christ. He did it first in these missals, and then... and calling the council and indicating his intention to basically completely, you know, refurbish, as he would call it, the church. He was beginning the changes that would make the Catholic Church no longer the Catholic Church. But
so
when
the
words of...
Are you trying to say then there was a concerted conspiracy after the war to overtake the church?
Absolutely.
Okay.
When this man was elected, there was a very... The election was contested. Some people are out there saying that this one person was elected. Well, the person they're saying was elected wasn't elected either. Neither was Ron Colley. John the 23rd was never elected a true pope, because by the time all the people got into that conclave to elect him, he had already been, for 2 years, they had already promoted him as a candidate for the papacy among various circles. Now, the Catholic Church and Pius XII in his election law governing, and it's the only election law that can govern the election of the future pope, in his election law, there's a special excommunication for people who go around promoting themselves prior to the death of the then reigning Roman pontiff. And once you're excommunicated, you can't vote, and you can't be voted for. Well, Ron Colley was not only allowing himself to be bandied about as the next pope, he was allowing other cardinals, other clergymen, to spread this all over, you know, the universe, basically. And by the time they got to the conclave, they already knew who they were going to elect. It was a foregone conclusion. Now, that invalidated the election. The Catholic Church also teaches, after that, that once a college has elected someone invalidly, they can't posit another election. They're not able to hold another election. So, for Ron Colley's excommunication, he was not pope. For the cardinals who voted for him, who promoted, you know, him, they are not cardinals. And there are a great many of them in that conclave that did. And he was not a worthy candidate for election, among many, many other things. But he was excommunicated. They couldn't vote for him, whether they knew. or he couldn't be elected, whether they knew that he was being promoted as the next successor of the Pope or not. He simply was never elected. Now, the ones that had any idea that he was not validly elected had the obligation to run out and elect a true pope. Well, they didn't do that. So for that, they're out. So basically, when Roncalli was elected, that wiped out the entire college of cardinals, and no one else but the cardinals can elect a true pope. So by the time they went to elect Paul VI after Roncalli's death, guess what? He wasn't a true pope either. They couldn't elect him.
So who's behind all this?
Well, the Freemasons burrowed their way into the Catholic Church over a period of 200 years. And they got into the clergy. They became bishops. They became priests. They became monks. They became nuns. They became lay people in high places. And they basically engineered this entire thing.
And so does that tie in with the fact that some of them utilize the term Jesuit then as being the same, doing the same thing? In other words,
had no power. The Jesuits really had no power to do this. That's what the funny thing is. The Jesuits, unless they're nominated as cardinals, you know, which I don't know how many might have been, you know, Jesuits. If we leave the Jesuits out of it, the first place that the Freemasons probably infiltrated was the Jesuits, or tried to. And that's clear from what Weishaupt did. But that's the logical place to go, because they're said to be the CIA of the Pope. And if you want to put it that way, that's probably what they were to a large degree. They protected the Pope. Well, that doesn't mean they were like the CIA. I don't like the analogy. But it had nothing to do with the Jesuits. The Freemasons would never limp themselves to that narrow an infiltration. It had to have been a broad infiltration over a long period of time, or this never could have happened.
Okay, now does this tie into the banking families of were they Illuminati or were they of other?
Well, now Nagaro was hired by Pius XII, and it's my belief he had. You know, a pope is such a busy man, and yes, he has to have his, you know, fingers in a lot of pies. The war really messed Pius XII up, but Nagaro was a Jewish man, and Pius XII thought he was the best guy for the job. Now, whether he was, you know, related to the banking families, I don't know that. He may have been. Did Pius XII know this? I don't know. But I know that Pius XII did not know what was done with some of the money or where some of the money came from, because if he had known, he could never have approved it. It wasn't found out until not the 50s, certainly, but the 60s or the 70s. It wasn't found out until the Sindona banking scandal broke, and they found out that a lot of this money had originally come from prostitution, gambling, you name it, all the, you know, the worst possible places. The church would never have approved if she had known. But, you know, her own clergymen betrayed her. Some of Pius XII's best friends, Spellman one of them, betrayed him. You know, and he was a lover, not a fighter. He had a great heart, and he believed the best about everybody. He was a very charitable man.
Saying Spellman was?
Yeah.
Really? Because I really...
Cardinal Spellman, yes ma'am. Who, after Pius XII died, rented a boat and went up and down the Tiber with a couple of sheep, promoting himself as pope.
Now,
that's Spellman.
Okay, let's go back over this just a little bit more. You're saying Spellman is noted to be a good guy for the church as opposed to one that was out there doing some things to tear down the church.
There were a lot of people that were basically promoting themselves as the most Catholic of the Catholic out there. Some of the American cardinals, some of them were good guys. Some of them really were. Others were not. And many of them in Rome had been Freemasons for a long time, and the fact just wasn't known. I mean, after all, it's a secret society for a reason. And, you know, some of these people, Spellman worked hand-in-hand with Montini and Roncalli during the war. Now, Roncalli not so much. Montini definitely. all these people worked in with each, you know, they all worked, you know, with each other to bring
out. What about Ratzinger?
Ratzinger was right in there with the best of them. You bet. And he, you know, the church in the past, in a distant past, the last, I think the last anti-pope she had was in the early 1400s. I believe his name is Felix. But in any case, she's had anti-popes throughout her history. But there's a really good reason to believe that these guys that we've had recently are anti-popes. And I wrote a book, actually, but I've withdrawn it from circulation because I wrote it with someone who helped me do the research, and I later discovered that some of that research wasn't what it should have been, so I withdrew it. However, there's a lot of truth in some of the things that were written in that book, and basically in the book it's proven, and it wasn't even our proofs. We took it from some other people who had noted it previous to us, but it's proven in that book that Paul VI was the Antichrist.
How would they have proved it? How would they have proved it?
I proved it in the book by quoting other people's proofs. How can you prove it? Using Catholic theology. The Catholic Church herself said that, remember the little children, what the little children heard? Rome will lose the faith and become the seat of Antichrist. Now, a Catholic pope can never become a heretic. That's not possible. But what can happen, and even one of the popes wrote a long, long bull on this, what can happen is that a man will be a heretic secretly, without anybody knowing about it, get into the papal chair. And then it's never happened before, and a lot of people didn't ever think it could happen. But then after getting into the papal chair, it can become clear that he is a heretic. And when that fact becomes clear, at the moment that fact becomes clear, he's no longer pope. He ipso facto loses the papacy. That's what happened to Ron Colley. Even before he was elected, he was excommunicated. It's what happened to Paul VI. Even before he was elected, he was excommunicated. But especially when he got in there and people could see that he was teaching things directly in opposition to Catholic dogma, And he did. He carried through with Ron Colley's For All Men by instituting the Novus Ordo Missae in 1969 and abrogating the Latin Tridentine Mass. They abolished the Latin Tridentine Mass with its For All Men, or for many, and not for all. And they instituted the Novus Ordo Missae, which said For All Men. Now, the true Catholic words are for many. Not for all, because Christ died for, you know, all men, but not all men followed him or would follow him. So you can't say, I mean, this is explained in the council documents of the Council of Trent. You cannot say that he died per se for all men, and that's not what the Bible says, even the Protestant translations. But Paul VI put for all men in the Novus Ordo Missae. He falsified the words of Christ and showed himself, by that very fact, to place himself above Christ and to be an antichrist. We say he's the antichrist. What is the number of his name? Paul 6. You turn his name and signature upside down like we did in the book, and you know what you get? 666. The way he signed his name, it was a perfect 666. Now, I know that's shocking. And there's a lot of other things that you can, a lot of sixes, incidents of sixes you can quote. And if you like, I can go into that a little bit.
Well, there's a couple of things that I'd like to have cleared up, because I've seen many, many pictures of world leadership bowing down to the Pope, and which I've always kind of wondered, is that just a gesture of honoring the Pope, or is that a gesture of giving allegiance?
I believe they're bowing to the Antichrist. See, the beast had many heads. The beast is the false papacy they set up in Rome. they set it up on the Seven Hills. Well, yeah, they did.
So you're saying that the church now is not the church that it was set up to be initially.
The church now is not the true church. The Catholic Church, as she existed from the time Christ died until 1958, is an entirely different church. The church today, calling itself Catholic, is not Catholic.
Okay, all right. Now that starts to make a little more sense. Now, was this Pope John VI a Mason?
I'm sorry, I can't hear you, Melody.
Was that Pope John VI a Mason?
Pope John XXIII was a Freemason. He was a Rosicrucian. There are pictures on the internet extant of him in his Rosicrucian regalia. Paul VI is also
Paul
vestments that are not, certainly not Catholic, and that some people interpret as a high level of Freemasonry. And he appeared publicly in those. At one point, in fact, somebody took a picture. I don't remember who it was or where it was exactly, but there's a picture in existence of that.
So, where do you think they were trying to take the church then, if they took it over and became this other organization?
Well, in order to kill even the idea of the church, they would have to make it out to be the ultimate evil. You know, the ultimate evil. You know, it not make it out to be. It would have to be, you know, in people's minds, the ultimate evil. And, you know, that's what they've done. Because, you know, everybody in the there were many people in the 1950s who wanted a greater participation of the laity in the church, who wanted a greater, they wanted to modernize the Mass, and Pius XII said, no, we're not doing that. We can't do that. This is our traditions. This is our, we will only go this far, and this is all the farther we can go. We can't, because Christ taught differently. Well, when John the 23rd got in, he said, oh, sure, we can do this. And Paul the 6th got in right behind him. He said, oh, we can do more than that. We can do this, and took it to the next level, which was abrogating the old Mass and instituting what is called the Novus Ordo Missae, the new order of the Missal. Not too much removed from the new order of the world. But I mean, this is how they did it.
So in other words, you're trying to say that in order for them to be bringing about this, the new world order, they would have to also bring down the Catholic Church.
The New World Order could only have been built on the ruins of what used to be the Catholic Church. Because Pius XII, I've got an article that I wrote for another website, and it pretty much explains everything, and it probably does it in much better fashion, and gives a lot of the proofs and everything. It's about 20 pages long. But you can, if you want to go to, it's I had it here. Let me bring it back up again. It is www.usasurvival.org, and it's, it says new report. It's in red, and it's about, I don't know, third thing down on the page. And this site has some other articles on the fact that the Vatican is at present very much involved in bringing about the New World Order and United Europe. And I don't disagree with that, but I want them and I want anybody I talk to understand that. That was not Pius XII's intent. The article that I have on this site explains that Pius XII had an entirely different vision of what he wanted for the Catholic Church, and it was not the New World Order.
Okay, I guess I'm being a little bit dense here, but a lot of the interviews that I've listened to and that sort, I've heard a lot of things that have tied Spellman into trafficking of children and things.
Absolutely,
of this
absolutely, and
okay.
I think it's true.
Okay, all right. So then I did misunderstand what you were saying, because I got lost. I thought I heard you say he was a good guy, and yet
presented as a good guy, but he wasn't.
Okay, all right. Okay, that's what I wanted to know.
There's an author by the name of Randy Engel, and I believe the book that it's The Rite of Sodomy or something like that. I think that's her book, but it basically explains that there's been a lot of talk. She believes Spellman was a homosexual.
Okay.
Many people believe Paul VI was a homosexual.
So it seems like we're seeing a lot. Although there's a lot of people that I hear that the Catholic Church had its problems long before it was taken over in the 50s, and I have to wonder, there was definitely some kind of thing going on between them and the monarchy in Britain, and I don't know if that needs to be.
What specifics, though? What do you mean by the monarchy in Britain?
Well, I mean, they were fighting back and forth, and I'm just wondering if that has anything to do with what ended up happening to this current period of time.
I'm sure it did, because Britain was always very much involved. And the Pope stood firm. I mean, you can look through any documents that, I mean, are available. At least I have never seen anything that would even suggest in the slightest that the Church gave one inch of ground, and everybody that I've read that's commented on the situation has said the same. That there was, now that's not to say that there weren't different instances of things in the Church that happened, bad things that, you know, were not addressed. I mean, I think if it came to the attention of the Pope, I believe that all of it was addressed. Some people may have kept it secret, just like Paul VI kept his activities secret. It's not an impossibility, especially given the two wars, which weren't really that far apart. That's when the seminaries, they started having a problem with the seminaries. And they very much noticed that there'd been an infiltration, and Pius XI went in and tried to strengthen the laws about what it took to ordain, become a priest, and how careful they had to be to select the right people, that sort of thing. In 1917, I believe, they started suggesting that changes be made in the liturgy. And by the 1940s, some people were already saying what amounted to the new Mass, and they were pushing for it. So there was an infiltration there, and it goes way back. Now, as far as the charges of sexual abuse go and everything, I know there've been some instances where, you know, people have said, well, it happened in the 40s, it happened in the 30s. I'm not saying that it didn't. I am saying that a lot of it didn't come out, or it did not become publicly known until the 60s, well, it's the 70s and 80s mainly, that it started becoming publicly known. Now, you know, how much of it, you know, really happened back then, I don't know. The one thing I do know is the Church believed in addressing it openly and getting rid of these people immediately in the past, before Pius XII died. Now, where that changed was when John the 23rd came into office, and you can find that in an article in The Guardian, and they gave a PDF of a, I'll read what it says, from the Supreme and Holy Congregation of the Holy Office, which is the Pope, basically, and it's labeled confidential, and it's an instruction that was written in 1962 by John the 23rd that said that all this stuff was to be kept secret, and that no one was allowed to talk about it, and that these priests were supposed to be transferred. And in other words, shuffle them around. I wrote an editorial several years ago, and I called it "Passing the Trash Only Breeds More Maggots," and that's exactly what they were doing. They were passing the trash around, and it was at the orders of John the 23rd.
Katie, you have any questions?
Within what's happening right now, do you consider our current pope to be a real pope?
No, I consider him to be an anti-pope.
So basically, this anti-pope thing has been going on since the 50s?
Since Pius XII died in October of 1958, yes.
Why has not the church itself taken this up?
Well, you know, the thing of it is, they have. And nobody, it was, that's the amazing thing. When all this happened in the late 1950s, people didn't really notice at first. They didn't start noticing until all the changes came about at Vatican II. You know, they took away everything. They took away the beautiful Latin hymns. They took away, they brought in modern altars. They brought in modern art. They brought in dancing girls. They brought in guitars. I mean, my mother was so traumatized, she wouldn't go back to church. I never, after 1969 and they instituted it, I went back for a very brief period of time to have my daughter baptized, and which I thought that I had to do. I don't think now that I should have done it. But I looked at it, and they had a singing Benji for the Easter service. Now, I'm sorry, but I just, that is a travesty. I knew that there was nothing left. They took everything from the church that had ever been hers. They turned the altar around. If you want to go back and read about what Antiochus, the Jewish Antichrist, did, that's exactly what he did. He put an idol on the altar facing the people in front of the Jewish altar and had them worship it.
Well, then it's got to be...
the idol on the altar that, as we believe, the idol on the altar that now sits there is the unconsecrated host, because after all this happened, they don't have any... They changed the rites of ordination. They changed all the sacraments. They changed the rites of ordination to the point where our priests are no better than what Pope Leo XIII judged the Anglican priests to be, which were not priests at all, because our sacraments are almost identical now to theirs. So therefore, you're not, the Catholic priests in these churches are not consecrating hosts, and they're not giving out true sacraments. They're committing sacrilege. They don't, I don't think, a lot of them are of goodwill, and they don't know this, but it doesn't matter. That's what they're doing.
So how do you, are there people within the church now that are trying to rectify this any?
You know what? They started coming out of the church in the 1960s, about the same time my family came out. They became what a lot of people know as traditional Catholics. They started going to old priests who still said the Mass in Latin. There's been traditional Catholics in existence in this country and all over the world since the late 1960s. They were everywhere. They were protesting, and they were petitioning Rome, and they were quite vocal. Well, they became infiltrated too, to the point where there's hardly, I mean, as we know it today, most of the people after the traditionalists were infiltrated, most of the people said, to heck with it. We're not going to anybody. We're staying home. We're going to do our stuff at home, just like our English ancestors had to do when they took the priests out of England, just like they had to do in Russia when they took away the faith. That's what we do. We say our mass prayers, we say our rosaries, we teach our children catechism, we homeschool our children. That's what we have had to do for decades. Nobody even knows hardly about us.
And what have they changed within the catechism teachings? I mean,
well,
has it all been basically eroded since the 50s?
Well, yes. I mean, they've changed the, for example, they took out of the, I mean, all the sacraments have been changed. So when you go to teach about the sacraments in your modern catechisms, they're not even the same. The form, the matter and form in the sacraments is totally changed. So you're not teaching about the true sacraments. You're teaching about a whole new set of sacraments and a whole new church. When you teach children about, assisting at Holy Mass, it's not the Holy Mass that the Pope said in the bull, quote, primum, had to, you know, no one ever could forbid the priest to say this Latin Mass, and that if anybody tried to abrogate his bull, may they incur the wrath of the holy apostles of God and the holy apostles Peter and Paul. I mean, this is, you know, these children aren't learning what the true Mass is. They're not learning what the true sacraments are. They are not learning the church completely relaxed all her teachings at Vatican II. And she became, if people would read the Vatican II documents, they would see where this new world order business is coming from. First, the Vatican II documents.
The Vatican 2000 documents.
No, Vatican II. The second Vatican Council documents, they were issued in books that were put out in 1960, anywhere from 1965 to 1970. They're probably online. But the Vatican II documents, the Vatican Council II documents, if you read them carefully, you will find references to the type of one world order they're trying to institute today. You will find references to a greater role for the laity that totally excludes, in a lot of ways, the priesthood. You'll find some references to liberation theology. I mean, that's a bad thing. That's the Che Guevara stuff. You know, I mean, there's a lot of, they were very sneaky. They had to be very sneaky. How do you boil the frog? Well, you don't boil him. You put him in warm water and keep turning the flames up, you know. They were turning the flames up slowly because they knew that a lot of Catholics would never accept this, you know, all at once. They did it gradually and very carefully. In 1965, Paul VI went to the UN and told him, here I am, you know, I'll do whatever you want me to, I'll help you in any way I can, you're the man. He told them that.
Then who,
I mean, in so many words. That's
who,
what
at the U, who at the UN was he kowtowing to is what I want to know.
Excuse me?
Who at the UN was that Pope abdicating to?
The UN Council. He was telling, it was a convocation. He went to New York in 1965, and it was was it the Council of 13? I don't know. Whoever sits on the UN Council, excuse my ignorance, but I'm not exactly fond of that organization. I don't know a lot about them. But their high council, basically, is who he spoke to. And he spoke to them in a public arena, and he was covered by the press, and basically, you know, he said that he would do anything he could to help, and that, you know, this is what we've been waiting for years, and anything the church can do for you. I mean, he's the one, not Pius XII, not any of these other popes ran as far away from one world government as they could. Paul VI is the one that welcomed it with open arms.
And so you're saying when these world leaders are bowing down, kissing the hand or whatever they are to show their honor of him, they're really trying to denigrate that position. Is that what I'm picking up here?
They're giving homage to a mockery of everything that Christ instituted and set up as divine on this earth. Yes.
Okay.
So this has ran so far off the track that is there a way of it recovering?
It's a question all of us, we keep in touch on the internet. We talk to each other on the phone. You know, we write things for each other, and it's something that all of us have been talking about for a very long time. At one point in time, traditionalists tried to elect their own anti-popes. I am sorry to say I was involved in an effort like that and was fooled for a very long time by this person. These people are very, very crafty and very, very good at what they do. And they will do anything to derail the church. And it's not, you know, it's amazing the lengths that have been gone to ensnare people. But I was lucky. I got shed of that. So I don't have to worry about that anymore. But now they have their own anti-popes, and the field is so messed up, nobody can play it. Here's what the teachings of the church are. The teachings of the church are from the First Vatican Council, which was held in the 1800s, and over 700 bishops worldwide attended this council, and so many that there's, you know, they've never had that many bishops at a council, I don't believe, in the whole existence of the church. Of course, that was in the 1800s, but at this council, they infallibly declared that the Pope's infallible, of course, but they also said that the church, as Christ constituted it, shall last until the consummation. Now, what the church means by those words is that Christ made the apostles priests and bishops. He made Peter the Pope. Well, that is how he constituted his church. He told them to go convert the people. So we have the priests, the bishops, the Pope, and the people. Well, those things will remain until the end of time. What is unto the consummation? Well, the consummation is when the world is all burnt up by fire and it ends. And so far, none of us have seen the end of this world. So therefore, we know that the church at some point is going to have to revive, but we don't know how. Because the way this was set up, all of these, every bishop, every priest, every pope has to come in an uninterrupted line from someone who can trace their lineage clear back to the apostles. I know this sounds pretty hard to believe that that can be done, but it was done by the church for centuries. And that line at this point in time has been totally eclipsed. We don't know. All we know, and this we go on by faith alone, all we know is somewhere there are true bishops and somewhere there are true priests, but we just don't have access to them. We believe that at some point in time, this is all going to blow up, and that maybe wherever these priests and bishops are, wherever they're being held captive, wherever they're hiding, they will be able to come out, and at that point in time, we can restore the papacy. Until then, we can't do it. The lady can't elect a pope. Pope Pius XII said in Six Ans et Cent, which was an allocution given in 1957, not long before he died, that the laity and the clergy are two distinct parts of the church. Only the clergy can elect a pope. Only laymen can be elected as pope. They can be, but they must and they have to be willing, ready for ordination and willing to be ordained. They have to be fit for ordination. That's the terms used in canon law. It's the terms used in all of the documents that the popes issued concerning ordination and consecration of their priests and bishops forever. You know, you have to be fit. It's no different than, you know, Barack Obama has to be a U.S. citizen to be a president, that argument. It's no different. The men that, you know, and you have to be fit. You have to have experience. You have to be a fit person. Well, there are no, once they did away with the proper ordination and consecration rite, once they did away with that in 1968, we don't know what has happened to the lines, because there are no valid and licit priests in the Church of Rome. There are none. There are somewhere true priests and bishops. We have to believe that because Christ told us, and he would not lie to us. We just don't know where. When we find them, we'll let people know.
Tell me if I'm correct here, but didn't the Catholic Church used to be one of the largest landowners in the world and had quite a fortune within its ranks, and do you think that's still there if that's the case?
Well, it might have been said about the modern church. I know that the papacy was close to being bankrupt during Pope Leo XIII's time in the 1800s, after they took over basically the Italian, the wars that were fought in Italy for independence, bankrupted basically the Vatican. They didn't even begin to recover until Vatican City was declared its own state, and that was in, I think, the 30s. And until that time, they didn't have a lot. They didn't have, maybe land was held like by the various orders and the kings and that were Catholic, but that doesn't mean that it was held by Rome, by the church. I mean, it was held by these organizations, but and it was administered to, but I mean that if you count all the, you know, if you count all the Catholic kings and stuff, that would seem, there's not a there weren't a lot of them left in the even in the 1800s because they'd already been their kingdoms had already been overthrown. So I don't know that that, you know, I don't know what the land ownership position was, to be perfectly honest, but they had to institute Peter's Pence in the 1800s just to raise money to do the things the church needed to do for her people. I don't, you know, if they'd had the land, if they'd had the means, I would think they would have sold some of it so that they could do that. It's something I would have to look into, but really, in the long run, what difference does it make if they owned land? Lots of churches own land. I mean, if you're a universal organization, you're going to own land, and you have to own land just to exist. I mean, you have to own churches, you have to own schools. You know, you have to own, look at the hospitals alone the church ran. If anybody wants to know the real nitty gritty on health care, here's what it is: health care became a mess when we lost the nursing nuns and the Catholic hospitals that were so reluctant to charge people what a thing was really worth because they were trying to be charitable. When that all went down the tubes, then we had a healthcare crisis. And that's one of the reasons now they're having to scramble to do for money what the Catholic Church used to do for a lot of people for free.
I mean, all this time frame that you're talking about is, I mean, very much the same time frame that seems to be have been developing for, you know, the takedown of this country from the inside as well. It looks like they were attacking all the institutions and sovereignties. Katie, you got any more questions?
Well, I see such a demolish of the Catholic Church, like Melody was just saying, in regard to the government. It looks like this has been a generational thing in regard to actually invading the Catholic Church and taking it over. If there is a group out there that is actually planning for this New World Order or the One World Order, how many generations has that taken within the church for it to come to this point?
Well, the permanent instruction of the Alta Vendita, which was issued in the 1800s, said it would take one generation. One. And it would take the little finger of the Pope, is what they wanted. They wanted the little finger of the Pope. The Pope, whoever he is, will never come to the secret societies. It is up to the secret societies to take the first step toward the church with the aim of conquering both of them. The task that we are going to undertake is not the work of a day or of a month or of a year. It may last several years, perhaps a century. But in our ranks, the soldier dies and the struggle goes on. We do not intend to win the popes to our cause, to make them neophytes of our principles, propagators of our ideas. That would be a ridiculous dream. Well, they got that then. That would be a ridiculous dream, and if events turn out in some way, if cardinals or prelates, for example, of their own free will or by surprise should enter into a part of our secrets, this is not at all an incentive for desiring their elevation to the See of Peter. That elevation would ruin us. Ambition alone would have led them to apostasy. The requirement of power would force them to sacrifice us. What we must ask for, what we should look for and wait for, as the Jews await their Messiah, is a Pope according to our needs. You know, it took them maybe two generations. Let's say we take the longest possible allowance for a generation, which is 70 years. It took them two generations to accomplish this, at the most.
Well, two generations, if we're looking at... you were saying like the 1950s. This would actually be like the fourth generation, correct?
Well, it depends on how you measure a generation. If this started at its, I mean, if it was at its most intense in the 1800s. So if you say you take 140 years from 1888 or whatever and add them up, I mean, we're about at, you know, the right juncture. Or if you take it even back to 1860. To the Vatican, the true Vatican Council that they held in 1869. I mean, but it, you know, it depends on how you measure generations. Some people say it's 40 years. Some people say it's 70. The Bible, I think, the longest time limit they give for it is 70 years. And
I've heard 20.
Excuse me?
I said I've heard 20.
Yeah, that's what I was thinking, was 20.
No, the biblical generation can be as long as 70 years.
Okay, so the near... Okay, well, I'm glad we clarified that, because I was definitely looking in a shorter time frame here.
It can be. It's not always. It depends. But it can be as long as 70 years. And like I say, because we're living longer, it would make sense to me to take it in the long sense versus the short sense. Because I think at times they took it in a shorter sense because people didn't live so long.
Okay, now what do you say about the Catholic Church possibly, if I'm correct in this thought, owning Temple Mount in Jerusalem? Is that correct?
Yasser Arafat, before he died, worked out a deal with John Paul II. He worked out some kind of a deal with him where those lands have already been handed over to Rome.
Okay, then I may have heard that correctly then.
A large part of Jerusalem has already been handed over to Rome. I have the document somewhere. I don't have it in front of me, and I it's on my other computer, and I can't access it right now, but... I know that this came out in 2003, if I'm not mistaken. Might have been closer to 2005, 2006, though. But you started hearing little rumors about it. But by 2006, it was well known that they'd made some kind of secret deal, and Yasser Arafat was the man that made it. And they handed, it was to be revealed at a later date, but they handed Rome over basically to, Jerusalem basically over to Rome. And some people believe, and it's not an impossible idea, that Rome will eventually move its headquarters to Jerusalem.
And what would the purpose of that be?
Well, if you have a one-world government... They might do it. And it was headquartered there.
It sounds like even though the church has gone down, that you yourself have kept your faith, your spirituality, and also your path that you are walking here. How difficult is that for people who are actually with the true Catholic doctrine?
You know, it's a hard thing to explain. For those who love, it's not difficult. You've got to love the church. And if you love the church, it's not hard. But what is hard is that everybody thinks, and everybody is quite vocal about thinking, that you're some kind of really rarefied nutcase. And that's not hard to tolerate on a personal level. At least it isn't for me. But what is hard to tolerate is on the level of Catholic teaching, that kills me, because it's so sad to know that if people, for example, I've invited people into my library, and I've said, you know, don't believe me, please don't believe me. I only write what I read in these books. You've got to come look at these books. Do you know that with the exception of maybe two or three people, nobody has ever come to check these things out? Ever.
Why do you think that
my
is?
Own kids? Because there has been such hatred built up against the church, and there is such fear on the part of some that she might rejuvenate and come back. But also there's such a vast indifference to whether or not she exists that it just doesn't matter to people anymore. They really believe that the church in Rome is the real church.
And what do you see as the biggest challenges?
Well, just remaining Catholic until I die. You know, my goal is to die a Catholic. And, you know, and to pass this on to my kids, those are the two greatest challenges. And, you know, the next generation is going to be weaker than this generation. We're weak enough already. Because you can't give them what you don't have. I don't have, you know, I mean, I didn't have the training in a lot of ways that I needed to be able to give this to them in the way that I would like to have given it to them, because by the time I was in upper grades, the church was already pretty much down the tubes. So, you know, if I had, say, I'd had the advantage of Catholic high school and a true Catholic college, now that would have really helped me a lot in a lot of different ways. But, you know, I didn't have those advantages. And, you know, if they can just hold on to the faith, no matter, you know, what they have to do it, they will save their souls, you know. And that's all we want. We just want to believe what the church always taught and believed, and we want to save our souls, and that's the... And we're doing the best we can do, even though we're very much sinners and we're very much, you know, we're not all good examples of what Catholics should be at all times, you know, and some of us have had, you know, very bad pasts and then have gotten up and become better people. You know, it's just like basically we're like everybody else. We're just sinners. But we just want to get to heaven and we want to keep our faith. That's all we want to do.
What, now, you have a website?
Yes.
It is what now?
It's www.betrayedcatholics.com.
And you do, and you have written some books, and they are?
Now, I want people to be aware of the fact that I've written, the one book I've pulled out of circulation. The other book, there is a book up called Surviving the Great Apostasy. I'm soon going to post a revised book that I wrote in 2003, and it's called Imposter Popes and Idol Altars. That gives the entire history of what has happened to the church in the last, I'm going to say the last 60, 70 years. It gives, and it goes back even further than that. It goes back to the beginning, but it gives it pretty much gives a history of the conspiracy and how it affected the church.
Well, Teresa, I really appreciate you coming on the program and you know, enlightening us from your perspective of what's happened to the Catholic Church, because I will have to admit that I hear a lot of different angles on it, and it has a tendency to blame the whole group when it's obviously just like any other organization. There are those that infiltrate it and take it down and from there, just like any country, or it doesn't really take
sure.
that many to do it. And I hope I'm stating that correctly.
Yes, pretty much.
Okay.
And Teresa, thank you so much. I've really enjoyed you being a Mythbuster tonight and giving us a new perspective.
Thank you so much for having me, and I really appreciate the opportunity.
Well, again, thank you, too, and I'll say good night.
Good night to everyone.
Okay.
God bless.